All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. This is Chapter 5, Supplemental Episode 6. Owen Thomas is one of the most prominent voices in modern web media. He is currently the editor-in-chief of ReadWrite.com, but he was also the West Coast editor for Business Insider, the founding editor of The Daily Dot, executive editor of VentureBeat, managing editor of Valleywag, and I could go on and on, Business 2.0, Red Herring, etc. I was excited to talk to Owen about some of his earliest jobs, though, those at Hotwired and at Suck. Owen gives us some more great background on the launch of Hotwired, as well as the inner workings of Suck.com. So please enjoy this conversation with Owen Thomas. Owen Thomas, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So doing my research on you, on your LinkedIn profile, you mentioned an early job was like an internship at Mother Jones, and getting Mother Jones on the web being like one of the first publications to go on the web. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes, it's actually so I can't take credit for getting Mother Jones online. That would be Joel Truer, who went on to have a career at Google, in various places. But he was the director of MIS, and he'd gotten Mother Jones online. But you know, the problem is he was the IT director at Mother Jones. So he was, you know, like setting up people's email addresses, you know, email accounts and things like that. He was busy, so he couldn't, you know, he couldn't actually publish the magazine to the web. So he needed interns. I had applied for an internship, and I think I was kind of vague about whether it was going to be editorial or like design and production, and I mentioned something about how I'd been playing around with HTML. So all of the intern applications for the magazine went directly to Joel. He kind of commandeered mine and said, "You're going to be a web intern." So that was my first gig after college, and I was thrilled to have it. It, you know, it got me out to San Francisco. It paid for like a bedroom in a co-op. This was long before Airbnb, so mm-hmm. I found that I found a place to crash through a friend of a friend, and you know, I was cranking out web pages. I was happy. I did eventually have to get like a real paying job, though, and that's when I became a webmaster at Publish Magazine, which was owned by International Data Group, or IDG, the uh-huh. publisher of PC World and Macworld. They're still around.
Right.
You know, it was a great job, and I got it because I knew how to take a magazine page and post it online. You had to know Quark, you had to know HTML, of course, BB Edit, Photoshop.
Had you done
all these tools?
Comp sci in college or anything like that? How did you get these chops?
I was an East Asian languages and civilizations major.
Okay.
But, you know, of course, there was a computer science lab, and we had a bunch of Next computers there. And the Next computer was actually that was the original platform that Tim Berners-Lee built the World Wide Web on. The first browser and server were on Next.
Right, and the first Mosaic browsers were built on that also.
Absolutely. So a friend of mine who is now a big big Burning Man burner dude introduced me to Mosaic, and you know that's where I kind of learned HTML and thought, you know, this is really kind of interesting. This is something, you know, something I could maybe do. But I was primarily thinking that Mother Jones might hire me for my desktop publishing skills, such as they were. This was back in the days of PageMaker. And, you know, but a lot of people were making the migration from desktop publishing to web publishing.
Right.
You know, it was similar skills. It was, you know, text and images laid out on a page, and you had to, you know, learn software to do it. And so Publish Magazine was in some ways a great place to be a webmaster, because, you know, I was learning from all these folks who had deep expertise in the old publishing world. You know, I could maybe teach them a thing or two about this very new kind of publishing.
So tell me about jumping ship to Hotwired. Did you go over to Hotwired after it had already launched, or?
So Hotwired had launched. I actually had tried to get a job there. I think I applied for anything. I think I applied for a customer support job there. It was, you know, it was just, I think, to use Louis Rossetto's rhetoric, this pulsing cyber station was the dream job of anyone working on the web. What I didn't realize is that there were folks inside Hotwired who were disgruntled and, you know, not very pleased with the content that Hotwired was producing.
Well, also at that time, wasn't there the whole controversy about it having a, not a paywall, but you had to sign, you had to register to see the content.
Yes, it was, to use the immortal words of Carl Stedman, a page that made you choose, log in or die. Because what are you going to do? You have to log in. So it had a registration wall, which is, I mean, it's utterly uncontroversial now. I mean, we're just so used to creating accounts, but, you know, back then it was like, wait, pick a username, set up password.
Well, because also, wasn't it that they got Lewis to agree to do Hotwired because he could see a business model for it if you could target ads to people, right? So if you signed up, he would know who you were, and then that's why he signed off.
Right. There were no cookies back then. There was no way to identify a user aside from an actual account. I mean, in some ways, it presaged Facebook, right? You know, like, no, we want to actually have our readers be identified. But the anonymity of web browsing was kind of taken for granted back then. There was very little tracking. You really couldn't track people other than by IP address. And so it really ran against the dominant culture of kind of internet insiders, who were the ones, you know, those were the only people around to read it. So, you know,
yeah, but that's interesting to me. Like, I've been reading up about Wired for this chapter, and it almost seems like, I think it's well known that Wired kind of presages the web exploding. And so, like, Wired kind of, we think of it in retrospect that it was the magazine of the web, you know, revolution or whatever. But there was almost sort of like the kids that were like, no, this web thing is where it's at, and you know, the magazine is sort of the old model and things like that. Like, was there that sort of a tension in terms of Hotwired?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there was, you know, like Hotwired was far more punk rock than, you know, than Wired magazine. And yet the, you know, the magazine staff felt like they were the ones bringing in the money. And Wired was fat with ads back then. Even very early on, there was literally nothing else like it on the market. So it was attracting all of these dollars from technology companies who wanted to seem cool, luxury advertisers and automobile brands who wanted to seem innovative. You know, it was just, it was an incredible time before everyone else kind of piled into that market.
Mm-hmm. So what was your role at Hotwired when you signed on?
So I really thought of myself as joining suck.com.
Okay.
So I'll tell you the full story.
Yeah.
A friend of mine, Mark Athatakis, who's now a writer based in Arizona, had applied for a copy editor job at Suck and taken a test, and they gave the job to someone else. And I was just so offended on his behalf, because clearly this person they hired was not very good at her job. They had typos left and right. So as a sort of revenge for my friend Mark, I started emailing the Suck team every day, an email with the subject line, typos du jour. And, you know, all of the misspellings, all the factual errors, anything else I took issue with.
And Suck was famous for, they always responded to, like, wasn't that a policy that you always had to respond to any reader emails?
Yes, and actually, this I later became the one who responded.
Okay.
That was, by the way, something I did at Mother Jones, is I answered the incoming emails, and people would ask all kinds of questions. There was no Google back then, and the search engines were rudimentary, so people would ask all kinds of questions about, you know, just like, how do I find this online resource? But getting back to how I got my job at Suck, for 4 months, April to August, I sent typos du jour to the Sucksters. And I think they realized that the woman who they hired as a copy editor was really much more talented as a writer. And so they made her a writer. And relisted the copy editor job. And Carl asked me if I knew anyone who might be interested. And I thought about it for maybe 10 seconds and replied, actually, I think I would be. So I came in, I interviewed, and I think it was pretty much a foregone conclusion.
How old is Suck at this point when you come on?
Suck was just a year old.
Okay.
In fact, I remember being there for the first Suckiversary, and I met Michael Sippy, who was back then was one of the writers. I can still kind of picture the backpack he was wearing. Hotwired was kind of at the height of its powers and its hubris. That's a time when we launched Wired News to take on news.com. Joel Truer, by the way, my boss at Mother Jones, had coincidentally joined Hotwired. Mm-hmm. He didn't have any role in my coming to suck.com. In fact, he probably would have warned them against it. But anyway, we both ended up there. It was kind of this vortex of talent.
Yeah, let me dial you back before you get into that, because I'm gonna get into the all the talented people that were there. But do you remember any of like the origin story? Like, it's Carl and Joey, Carl Stedman and Joey Enough, did you hear like it was pitched as sort of like a Mad Magazine for the web or something like that. Like, so this is like a Skunkworks project kind of inside Wired and Hotwired, right?
Well, Skunkworks would suggest that it had some kind of authorization. It had no authorization.
Really?
Joey and Carl just set it up on a server that I think they had, quote unquote borrowed with the help of an engineer.
Company
and they just they just took up space on one of the servers in the Hotwired server farm. This was pre-cloud, pre-really data centers, so all of the servers that ran Hotwired were on site. And they just started posting because they thought that Hotwired was producing this, this content that it wasn't true to the web. It was like trying to be a magazine version of the web. And it wasn't fast enough and it wasn't interesting enough. So they wrote about things they cared about and they did it every day. There was not a lot of daily content on the web back then. It was
right because Hotwired is still basically kind of repurposing its monthly content, even, or are they even doing weekly?
They were doing a lot of original content, but they were doing it on like on a weekly schedule at best.
Okay.
And Joey and Carl felt like that was not the the metabolism of the web.
Like already guessing that what you want to do is you get into work every morning and go to your favorite website and.
Exactly, and that's that's precisely what I did. When I worked at Publish, is I fired up suck.com to see what they had to say. So that establishing that free the idea of frequency, and habit, was a key innovation that Joey and Carl had. And then there was the tone of it. Like, it was written in this knowing, sarcastic, funny voice. That, certainly didn't take itself too seriously, but didn't take anyone else seriously either.
Well, so, and also people are writing under pseudonyms. So I assume that this was sort of signed off on. So are they writing under pseudonyms because they're trying to hide it, that they're doing this?
They were trying to hide that they were doing it.
Huh.
Now, they weren't trying to hide very hard.
Right. And
eventually, eventually management at Hotwired figured out that the Suck server was actually in their own data center, but that took them a while to figure out. And after that, it was pretty easy to trace it to Joey and Carl.
So it's kind of this is a whole package. It's like we're kind of doing this DIY underground sort of stuff, and we're doing it under pseudonyms, and so that lends itself to like the voice of like kind of outsidery, snarky sort of voice just by its nature of what they're doing.
Yes, but decidedly not anti-capitalist. Joey especially always embraced the idea of selling out. And so the story of how Suck got bought by the company that was unknowingly giving it shelter was itself grist for the Suck mill.
Right. Well, we'll get to that in a second. Let me ask you, like aside from that, like, do you feel like, because I'm kind of like a year or two too young to, I was aware of Suck, but I wasn't like a huge reader or whatever. Do you feel like some of the culture sort of came from like that zine culture, like the early 90s sort of like neo-punk rock culture? Because like the first articles are about like the Kurt Cobain conspiracy theories and
oh, absolutely. I mean, it was a zine, it was a zine on the web.
It was very simple. Like it was black on white and one column.
Yeah. The amazing thing is that the site is completely mobile optimized today. You can read it on an iPhone. It looks great.
Right.
And that's the other thing is that, Joey and Carl were designing it
to actually be read on the computers and browsers of the day. And in the 90s, a lot of people had, really, really underpowered PCs, tiny monitors by our standards. And they were on, maybe 9600 kilobit per second modems, which is unfathomably slow to us.
Like, right.
You can't even, I can't even explain how slow that is to a kid today.
It's way slower than Edge, just let's stipulate.
But, but Suck would actually load. And, whereas Hotwired's experimental layouts with these huge images would just crawl. And, it didn't occur to the designers at Hotwired because they were all sucking down, broadband speed internet through hot pink Ethernet cables.
Mm-hmm. Actually, before I get onto the other stuff on the pseudonyms, yours was Jonathan Van Decimeter.
It was.
Could you care to give us the etymology of that, or
can I unpack that?
Yeah,
Jonathan Van Meter was a magazine editor and writer, and he was most noted for asking if we were living in a quote unquote post gay moment. And I'm gay, and that kind of spoke to me because the conventional gay identity of the 90s mm-hmm. didn't really mesh with my my interest in the web and internet culture. There definitely were gays online. Mm-hmm. There was Planet Out back then,
right? Going back to AOL days or something, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Planet Out first launched on I think on MSN, but rapidly embraced AOL as its primary platform. The kind of post-gay thing really spoke to me. So, and I thought, well, I'm only a tenth the writer that Jonathan Van Meter is. So I will call myself Jonathan Van Decimeter. The funny thing is that someone at some point got confused and thought Jonathan Van Meter had written my essays, and so Jonathan Van Meter actually got in touch with me and said, "Hey, who are you?" And we had a nice exchange, which was a little bit of a fanboy moment to hear from one of my literary idols.
Well, let's get into that because. Suck clearly had such a huge following amongst it. It's not just media, but it is media, but it's also a specific type of media. Like it's the media that's trying to get the web. I would say that reading, cause there's still great archives online of Suck. Go to suck.com. And it's almost pitched to the cubicle workers that are working at these what are becoming the .com companies, you know what I mean?
Right.
And a lot of the early stories are like sort of almost diaries of like, my boss doesn't get this and that sort of thing.
Yeah, TV for the Blind is an essay that I think it resonates today. I think you could show that to anyone working in online media. Dealing with a parent company whose business is cable TV or print or what have you, and it would still speak to them. I think that those early essays really, really kind of established Suck's identity as an outsider, and yet an insider. Carl and Joey were, they were inside the beast. They were part of this company that was trying to go public and, make a big profitable business off of online media. And yet they felt pretty strongly that Hotwired was doing it wrong. And
because they're still tied to the traditional magazine model of there's a schedule, there's a week, there's an issue, there's a,
Yeah, I mean, it was some of it was, just taking those fusty magazine habits to the web. Part of it was misunderstanding the web, and so trying things that were very experimental and weird and just didn't make any sense if you actually thought about how people behave online. But the fundamental mistake that people make is that people thought that Suck hated the web, that they thought the web sucked. You know, they thought that the web sucked today, but that it could be better tomorrow if people just woke up and paid attention and said something. So it was trying to be a voice for all these people who, you know, who saw that people were doing the web wrong. You know, you're doing it wrong, and had passion, not out of hate, but out of love for the web, love for its potential, love for what it could become.
The reason I'm you know, focusing more and more on this next chapter with Suck is, you know, lots of people have made this connection, not just me, that it's almost like the voice of the web sort of kind of comes from Suck in a way, and not just in the sense that it's almost like it's proto-blogging, like, you know, we're putting stuff up on a daily basis, but also like that snarky outsider voice and things like that. I don't know if I actually have a question on that, but what do you feel about like the idea that Suck kind of, that's the internet's voice now, whether it be Reddit or whether that's the progenitor of blogging and things like that?
Absolutely. I do think that Suck gave birth to kind of that, you know, that bloggy voice, for lack of a better term. You know, I should mention there's a direct historical connection. Carl Stedman was at one point close friends with Ben and Mina Trott, who went on to found Six Apart, which was one of the first blog software companies.
Right, right.
But you know, even people who didn't know Joey or Carl personally, or you know, lived far away from San Francisco, read Suck and were inspired by its voice. It wasn't just the words; it was the way that they hyperlinked. A hyperlink could be expressive in all kinds of ways that you know, people coming from print, you know, or TV would never imagine. A hyperlink can be explanatory. A hyperlink can be it can be a joke. It can be sarcastic.
There's a quote that I love that says, "With Suck, you wouldn't get the joke until you punch through on the link."
Yes,
that's from Mark Derry.
Yes, absolutely.
So yeah, again, progenitor of, there's tons of link blogs, or even what Twitter does. It's like, well, okay, not what Twitter does, but the link blogs.
No, I think Twitter's a great example where, you know, you kind of have this voice where you say one thing and mean another, and the punchline is in, you know, is in the link or the photo or whatever you've attached. And that kind of, you know, that it was a very Generation X voice. So you see it in, you know, you saw it in other, you know, in other media, you know, novels and movies from the day. Mm-hmm. But Suck kind of crystallized it for the web and made it, you know, made it a part of the web. And, you know, even though I think people don't talk that way in movies or books anymore, there's kind of this fossil of the mid 90s that lives on in this web voice.
You know what I see when I read the archives and stuff, and I'm 36, so again, I'm still kind of this generation or whatever, but it reminds me of what The Daily Show later became, and actually some people that worked at Suck went to work on The Daily Show and things like that, but like, you know, like some of the stuff like sending out reporters to cover the Alan Keyes campaign or the Miss America pageant or sending someone to Bangalore to report on outsourcing, like, again, that sort of outsidery, like, we're not taking any of this seriously, even ourselves, kind of stuff.
Yeah, and you know, and yet we're doing it, right? We're, you know, we're bearing witness. Mm-hmm.
the that idea of bearing witness and, you know, and speaking the truth, however painful it may be to you or offensive to others, was just a core value. You know, I think Joey was always the kind of gritty pragmatist, and Carl was the dreamer. Carl was the utopian of the pair. And those threads, you know, I see threads of Joey and Carl throughout the web today. The utopianism and the mercantilism.
Well, it's sort of like the web is equal parts like Peter Thiel libertarianism and hippy dippy, you know, 60s sort of stuff. I have actually a technical question for you, which I already know the answer to, but I'm assuming you guys had nothing like a CMS at this point, right?
We had some scripts that published published the site, but you basically had to you basically had to drop the files in the right directory.
Specifically, if you sent in a column, you're sending over what, a Word or a text file or something, and then someone literally has to write that, do the HTML and put that on the thing, right?
Yes, and that was me.
Okay.
Or I think at some point we got a production manager who did some of that work. But the funny thing is, like, if I had to, back in the early days when we actually did line breaks, mm-hmm. If I fixed a typo that changed how a line would break, I would have to fix the line breaks for the entire paragraph. I'm not sure if that even makes sense.
It does to me. And listen, if you're listening and CMS makes no sense to you, that's a content management system. It's how basically any online publication functions these days. It's a publishing software program, essentially.
And there was there wasn't anything like it. Part of the reason why Joey and Carl could start Suck is because they worked in production for Hotwired, so they knew how to create an HTML page and upload it to a server in a way that it would actually display in a browser.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause Hotwired didn't have a CMS at this point either.
No. They built one for Wired News. Mm-hmm. But that was, you know, and they built it in-house, and that was kind of a wild thing that they, you know, that they built that. 'Cause you weren't going to hand code a news article. But even, you know, up to the point, even up to 1999 when I was at Red Herring, we still didn't have a content management system. We were just uploading files to a server.
Hmm. Well, can you give us just like a little background? You leave and go back to Wired Digital or something. Like, is this the point when they're starting to be layoffs because they're missing their IPOs?
Yes. So in 1996, Wired tried to go public. They got close twice. I remember actually being at a party in downtown Second and Mission, and we were expecting, you know, I think we had rigged something up to see the Wired ticker symbol, which was WWWW, four W's, mm-hmm. rather than three, kind of scroll across. And, you know, then people were running over to internet connected computers, because we didn't have mobile devices then, and checking their email, and the word was spreading that the IPO was off. So that was in the fall of the fall of 1996. Mm-hmm. By March 1997, we'd had round after round of layoffs, and I was one of the folks laid off. I did do some freelance work for Wired News and Wired Magazine, and then I got a job at Red Herring.
I need to do more research on Red Herring, because, again, that's another publication that kind of predated the web revolution, but I remember that along with like Industry Standard and other like. So you worked for them for several years, like right in the meat of the .com mania, right?
Yeah, it was crazy. I was I was covering pets.com. I think, you know, just in its founding. I interviewed Jeff Bezos once. He'd come down to buy a payments company based in I think it was San Mateo. This was pre PayPal, and that actually started a now career long fascination with the whole world of payments. But yeah, I mean, the red herring, there was really nothing like the red herring. This was before the industry standard. The industry standard was actually founded as a weekly. And seeing the success of red herring, Wired at one point had wanted to do a business title, but the canceled IPO put that on hold. Business 2.0 started around the same time. And I actually, after the Red Herring, I joined Time Inc. I worked for Time Magazine for a while and then came back to launch a magazine in 2000 called eCompany Now. And eCompany Now existed for about a year, and then we bought Business 2.0 and took it over. And then I spent most of the kind of bust years in the Web 2.0 years at Business 2.0.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Can I ask you, not from a, oh, what was the .com stuff like? Because I've asked a lot of other people that, like, but as like a, as like a journalist, like a free, you know, not freelance, but, you know, you're going to different titles and whatever. Like, was this like sort of like the, was this also like a golden age for this sort of journalism? Like, man, just there's a story every second, and you know, let's go. There's another new .com and stuff like that.
I mean, I remember at Red Herring in 1997, we were, our goal was simply to do a story a day. And by the way, I was the only writer, and in fact, I wasn't even hired as a writer. I was a copy editor and production editor. And what my boss and I realized is that all of the magazine writers were too busy putting the magazine together because it kept getting more and more ad pages.
Right, so, that's the other thing. There's money coming in to you guys at like the .coms also.
Yeah, no, and so it was a great day if I got some press release about some startup getting funded, because that was a rare event even in 1997. And you know, I would do these long interviews with folks like Ross Garber of Vignette, which is actually one of the first content management systems, speaking of, out there. And it was a fun time to really learn the trade. I mean, that was my kind of on the job education. The reason why I got into reporting is simply I was getting so many news tips from my friends who had taken jobs at places like Excite or InfoSeek, and you know, they were going through wild reorganizations and mergers and acquisitions. And I'd go to my boss and say, well, is there anyone who can write this? Because this seems like a great tip. And she'd look at me and say, I think you're going to write it, Owen, because no one else will. and that's, that's how I got my start. And it's hard to imagine, in kind of another era that, that I'd get to do that. I also started writing a column of just, people getting hired and fired, kind of moves and promotions. And that was a great way to just get to know everyone in the industry.
Right.
Is, who doesn't like a little write up of their promotion or their new job.
Or a little gossip, I guess.
Yeah. And it did kind of turn much more gossipy over time. And, I'd hear rumors about like Mary Meeker getting courted by Kleiner Perkins that turned out to be true just like 12 years later. and so I just, learned as I went, but that, that idea that we would just kind of, hope that someone was going to fund a startup in 97, by early 99, it was just crazy. And at that point I was a more senior reporter on the team. And I said, I told my colleagues, at this point we're five or six people purely on the online side of things. I said, we're not going to write about it unless it's at least $10 million. Mm. These days, I guess it's, $100 million, $200 million before you really care. But I saw things getting crazier and crazier back then. And it's funny now, there's so much controversy over whether startups are overvalued and what's the right way to do a seed round or a series A or what have you. And I have all of this muscle memory from covering the startup industry in the 90s that's just completely wrong today. It's just the practices have changed so completely.
Well, and it's orders of magnitude different. I mean, it's not.
Yeah, there's way more money from way more sources and way more startups. So those are step changes. It's exponentially more, more complex.
But it's also maybe it's not that mania of throwing money at whatever, and throwing things against the wall and whatever sticks. Like I'm not saying that every great startup is a great idea, but there was a time period when it was like, okay, like you said, okay, pet food online, pets.com, you know what I mean? Like it feels kind of more thought out, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, pet food online was a terrible idea in 1998.
But it's a smart. It works now.
Yeah, it totally works now because we've got the infrastructure. People are comfortable using credit cards online. Well, that's a whole nother story. But
right.
It's. And people do, like, they actually go to Amazon and they do subscribe and save and they just get their
right. People
their
are comfortable ordering that it's an order and get it delivered to your doorstep lifestyle now.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is with pets.com, the more that they advertised, the less traffic they got to their site.
Really?
I mean, yeah, it was crazy because essentially they were driving brand awareness of their sock puppet. But they weren't getting anyone to buy because people felt like, what? By the time I load the page and put the dog food in my shopping cart and check out, I could have driven down the street and bought some dog food.
Right.
And I don't have to wait 3 days for it.
I might need to talk to you in a few episodes about that. I'm gonna let you go because you've been kind with your time already. But you mentioned sort of the gossipy stuff earlier, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you some of your later stuff, like for example, Valley Wag, and how you got brought into you were the second editor of Valley Wag.
Actually, third if you count Nick Denton as
okay
in his interim role,
and Nick Douglas.
And Nick Douglas was the first.
Right.
I mean, absolutely. I have to say my time at suck.com was
right. That's why I asked, because it
was
sort
probably
of
instrumental,
right?
For, you know, in rising to Nick Denton's attention. He definitely had a thing for ex-Sucksters. He also hired Anna Marie Cox, who was a senior editor at Suck at the same time as me.
Right, famously Wonkat.
Famously as Wonkat. You know, because if you look at Gawker, the voice of Gawker was very much inspired by Suck.
Agreed. And today you're editor-in-chief of Read Write, and I always kind of end these by asking people, you know, whether they be in advertising or you know, a programming aspect of it or whatever, but a lot of what we talk about on these is it's 20 years on, and so in terms of like the online media as it exists now, when you were doing this at Suck 20 years ago, is the web what you imagined it back then? Is it better? Has it gone beyond what you imagined, or has it not quite gotten to where you hoped it would be yet?
I think that, you know, in terms of the technical development of the web, it's mind-blowing, especially, you know, what's especially nice to see is that we were kind of right. We didn't, at Suck, we were very critical of kind of multimedia whiz-bang things, like, you know, there was something called VRML, or virtual reality markup language, and
right.
We thought we were going to fly through websites, you know, in some kind of 3D, you know, 3D artificial landscape. No. And things like Java actually was thought of as like an animation tool, and we were very critical of that, and it turns out Java was much more useful on servers, running applications.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to see the utility of the web today, things like Gmail, things like Dropbox, I think those are amazing. I think the whole mobile world would have been very hard to predict. Though, by the way, Wired, in this much criticized cover about push technology, pretty mm-hmm. much predicted the whole world of
right
of notifications and location services and what have you. They were just really early to it. I think the thing that still disappoints is that the web has not achieved its full potential as a community. You see little glimmers of it with people coming together on, say, Twitter or Reddit, and then they just do something awful.
Way? Like, what do you mean? Like, it's not a community that, because the argument I would make is like, you know, you can be any niche interest right now, and you can find your people, right?
Yeah. No. I mean, and that is great. That is really wonderful. But I'm thinking of the way that Zelda Williams was hounded off of Twitter, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, the culture of trolling. Some would argue, you know, was Suck responsible for that? I mean, we were hiding behind pseudonyms, not very effectively, but we were criticizing people from behind a mask.
Right.
You know, and especially in the early days when people didn't know who Joey or Carl were, you know, were they the original anonymous internet commenter?
Yeah.
But I think the difference is one of intent. I think that Suck always did have this kind of core of love, you know, this utopian belief that however bad the web was today, it could be better.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to say something about it. You couldn't just sit there and take it as it was. You had to point out all of the flaws and all of the weaknesses. I think, you know, if we're to remember anything from Suck, and it's that criticism should have a point and a heart, and a sincerity. And that's something actually I took with me to Valleywag that people often misunderstood. They thought I was kidding. They thought, you know, like no one could possibly be that harsh about, say, Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I really meant it. You know, I really thought they were screwing up a good thing. And that's why I was as tough on them as I was.
You know, that's a beautiful way to end it. So I'm almost ruining it now. But I have one more question. There's been a lot of articles recently, like on Medium and a bunch of other places, about like, is journalism dead versus this is the golden age of journalism? And you're someone that your entire journalism / editorial career has been web and post web and stuff like that. How do you come down on that? Is it the golden age of journalism, or is journalism dying?
I think it's far harder. You know, if you were to start something like Suck today, would anyone notice? How would they find out about it? You know, we definitely have a problem of discovery, as you know, as they like to say, if I use a trendy buzzword. I actually don't think that the excess of of writing. I don't think there's an excess of writing on the web. I think it's great that everyone is free to say something. That was the dream of Suck.com, right? That everyone would kind of start speaking up and speaking their mind. But how do you find the good stuff?
Right.
It's a really hard question.
I mean,
in the early days of the web, there was so little online. Like, browsing around and discovering a new website was, you know, was this kind of magical pleasure.
You know, what I was almost about to argue with you and say, like, well, what about things like Vox or 538? But then those are started by people that got there first, you know, like the Ezra Klein's and Matt Iglesias's, and the, you know, like they were people that were early bloggers, you know what I mean? So I see what you're saying about like the discovery. Like, if you had a good voice right now, how do you get heard?
Right. I mean, what Vox Media is doing is they're kind of picking up people from, you know, the minor leagues or from other teams, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like the way that Vox pretty much poached the core team of Engadget,
right,
to form The Verge, or picked up Ezra Klein from the Washington Post.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's a new ladder to climb, but it's far less clear how you do it.
Well, Owen, thank you so much for remembering all this for us. And that was, you know, that was a great, I like these conversations when they're, I love to hear the histories and the oral histories, but I also like to get a little, you know, deep thinking about stuff. So this has been great.
Oh, my pleasure.
If you're enjoying this podcast, there's one simple thing that you can do to help us out. If you do nothing else, just go to iTunes and rate us. 1 to 5 stars takes about 2 seconds. Or give us a review, because the weird way that iTunes works is it's not just the number of downloads, it's also the number of ratings and reviews. As always, you can join the conversation at www.internethistorypodcast.com. Get more info, see pictures, and see my full bibliography for each episode. The show's Twitter is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.